Hello and welcome to The Negotiating Ideas. I'm your host, Omar Sadr. This episode is a conversation between Noah Coburn and me. Noah is a political anthropologist who focuses on Afghanistan and South Asia, studying violence, governance, and how people negotiate the overlap of politics, power, and culture. He teaches at Brinkton College. He has conducted field research in Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Nepal, India, and Turkey. His book, Bazaar Politics, Power and Pottery in an Afghanistan Town Market, based on 18 months of research with a group of potters in the town of Stalevs, some 30 miles north of Kabul, explains how various lineage of potters and other craftspeople in the town worked together to maintain peace even while the insurgency grew rapidly in the neighboring districts. This conversation was originally recorded for some other purpose. We discussed a wide range of issues, including Afghan nationalism, how multiculturalism or intercultural dialogue may fit in Afghanistan, and alternative institutional arrangements. At the end, we also discuss how public intellectuals failed in their encounter with the Taliban. So here you go.
Let's start by talking a little bit about your own sort of educational and intellectual trajectory. What brought you to political science and ultimately to study multiculturalism?
Well, to start with, I think it was a kind of deep interest that I had with politics as a practice, but also politics as a knowledge, an intellectual activity. And that led me to, at early on, when I started my education, I opted for political science and then continued to PhD. As cultural diversity is concerned, what I have wrote my PhD thesis on, I think that I observed one of the key challenges of the society in Afghanistan was how to come along with its own multiple forms of diversity, starting from societal to cultural to moral, right? So you had all these challenges, and Afghanistan, throughout its modern history, over 120 years, failed to find out an accommodative way in order to establish a kind of stable, democratic, but at the same time, accommodationist political sphere. So that was a puzzle for me. When I started my PhD at South Asian University, I think the university, and particularly professors, I must say, and I must acknowledge, they have impacted my thinking to a large extent. South Asian University was a multicultural where we met people from at least 8 different SAARC nations, South Asian countries, and it was a sphere of kind of practice of cultural dialogue there. But at the same time, professors there encouraged us to be critical of the surrounding. And therein I came across, despite the fact that my PhD was in international relations, but interestingly, we had the chance to, for example, get exposure to many other disciplines, but also international relation discipline was, unlike, for example, North America, there it was taught as a multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary perspective. So I came to know about some mainstream theories of multiculturalism, and that was interesting where I could have connected what was the challenge here in Afghanistan and how the Western examples or models dealt with diversity in their societies. So I explored more a bit, particularly Indians also, apart from Western examples and models of multiculturalism, Indians also studied their own society. So juxtaposing these different models between India and North, for example, North America or probably Anglo-Saxon societies, but also other classical examples that we had in Persian cosmopolis, the medieval Middle East, for instance. That all made me to write something on this. And I think my PhD supervisor encouraged me, why don't you look at this issue from an IR lens. So it was really a challenge for me, because to argue from an IR standpoint and trying to make a conversation between mainstream theories of international relations and those of political theory. But so my effort was how to contribute to IR as a discipline, where the department asked me to do that, but at the same time, how I can, for example, draw these Western theories and, for example, juxtapose them with local understandings or non-Western perspectives and have a conversation with Afghanistan as a society. So this was also an effort in order to bring in non-Western perspectives and challenge the mainstream knowledge which was constructed in West, both in IR, but also in multiculturalism. So that's why what came out at the end of this project was a critical lens to multiculturalism, where I brought critical multiculturalism along with another perspective, which is called intercultural dialogue, mm-hmm. together, and applied in the case of Afghanistan.
Well, and I think one of the things that really comes through in your work and is a real strength of it is the influence of the Indian positionality, I think, of a place that has long engaged with Western political discourses and yet exists in a cultural societal context that's very different than that. Yeah. And watching you sort of apply some of those theories to Afghanistan is one of the really interesting pieces of the work. And let's step back a little bit too, because one of the earlier chapters in your book, you sort of set up the history of Afghanistan nicely, talking about, in particular, the history of Afghanistan nationalism, and as you say, its discontents, which is a key starting point for your understanding. Can you give a brief sense of what is the root of this discontent, and how should we understand that historically?
Nationalism, like many other phenomenons to the global South and non-Western society, was some sort of an imported idea. It came, of course, the history of nationalism in Afghanistan transformed different stages, but it was primarily introduced at early phase by the constitutionalist movement in early 20th century to Afghanistan. That was, of course, borrowed from the Turkish model, and the Turkish model, of course, borrowed it from the European model, where it imagined a construction of unified nation based on one language, one land, and one state, to make it very simple. While the previous version of nationalism, which came after the Anglo-Afghanistan encounter, was anti-colonial, primarily, it was driven by an idea to establish an independent state and push back the Western colonial intervention. But slowly and gradually, that anti-colonial nationalism converted itself under, for example, new imported idea from the Ottoman Empire, where figures like Mahmud Tarzi was quite influential, into an ethno-nationalism. And you see manifestations of it in different spheres of state, for example, when the modern education system was created in Afghanistan. So the modern education itself was one of the key pillars of shaping nationalism, but at the same time propagating this nationalism. So if you go through, for instance, the formal curricula of a school, which was established in Habibia College, the very modern college in Afghanistan. The way, for example, Afghanistan is defined as a geography, then Afghans as an identity is defined, that's all an effort by the modern nationalists of the time to craft a new nation, to craft a new state, and craft a new identity. Apart from modern education, I think modern media also created or played a very constructive role in that sense. For example, Saraj al-Akhbar, which was an anti-colonial Persian medium newspaper, despite the fact that it was published in a very low value, but it was circulated widely among the intelligentsia in Kabul, but also in the region. For example, we come across texts which says that how Persian Tajiks in Central Asia were reusing the newspaper, but also how, to what extent this paper had an influence in subcontinent. So Mahmud Tarzi, who was the chief editor in the second phase of Saraj al-Akhbar, his main desire is how to craft a new state. So he's an advisor to the king, to the Shah also. So Amir Habibullah, and later on in the second phase to Amanullah as a minister, but also the one who is an ideologue. So he is the one who is imagining a new state and imagining a new nation. So different articles talks about what is responsibility of a state, for example. He is the one who's for the first time translating an international law book, for instance, to Farsi. So elaborating on the responsibilities of the state, both in the international community, but also locally, responsibilities of the king. What is a nation, for example? That's one of the key questions that he's interested to. And then he is the one who defines four key elements of nationalism in Afghanistan. And that is, I think, the religion. So he tries to reconcile Islam as a belief, as a faith that majority of the people follow with politics, with the state. So it's Islam, and then it is state, Dawlat, Deen, Dawlat. And then also, I think he talks about Millat, the nationhood. And finally, the king, the symbol of the state. So that is the second one, the media. So Sarajul Akhbar was very instrumental in shaping the ideas of intelligentsia in early 20th century. When you come a bit forward, so second decade of 20th century towards the third decade, so slowly state establishes modern institutions in order to, for example, construct a modern history, because a nation is impossible without a modern history. So that's why Anjuman Tarikh Afghanistan, the historical association of Afghanistan, was an outcome of merging of various literary associations, which were created in late 20s and early 30s of 20th century. The mandate of the association was to narrate a history of a nation, which is, for example, here in UC, and the constant effort to connect ancient history with medieval history, with modern history, and also narrate the history exclusively based on one dynasty and one state. So that's why history of Afghanistan in the medieval era, which is deeply connected with the region surrounding it, and the historical association tries to detach it from the region. And carve out Afghanistan as an isolated state or as a separate state from the region, from, for example, subcontinent or the West Asia, for example, the Persian, larger Persian cosmopolis or Persian empires. So what is the discontent now in the nationalism? As I said, in early stage, it was anti-colonial. So it didn't have much to do with what is an Afghan nation. It was just anti-colonial. But later on, as it moves on to create the identity of a state, identity of nation, and history, it somehow falls into the realm of ethno-nationalism, because Afghanistan as a society is quite multicultural, diverse, but the way identity of a state was defined, it was exclusively based on one ethno racial identity. And that led to marginalization of many other communities, be it in terms of history, be it in terms of narrations, be it in terms of culture or national identity, to the emergence of political narrative. And that somehow created a kind of crisis for the country. Because the way, for example, if you want to connect medieval or ancient history with a modern one, you need to, for example, reinterpret in a manner that you have to be selective. So history was nationalism, the way it uses history. It is not using it in an inclusive manner, but it's cherry picking. It is exclusive. So you pick certain elements of history that you would like to, but exclude the rest. And this exclusion means that's meaningful, because you are not excluding episodes in history, but you're excluding really communities which are associated with that history, with that identity. So this led to a kind of crisis of identity for Afghanistan. The statecraft, and at least in the first half of 20th century, was heavily influenced by Aryan nationalism. And for example, you see encounters between Musahiban dynasty and Hitler, for example, and the Germans, and the way Germans, for example, influences the idea of statehood in Afghanistan. So that creates a very exclusionist kind of identity for a state, the one which is driven by the desire to homogenize the country. And then you see when the country moves toward the second half of 20th century, it enters a phase of violent crisis because it cannot come along with what is defined as an identity for the state.
And very interesting, because it makes me think of informal politics and politics as a lived experience, and you earlier discussing politics as an intellectual activity. One of the interesting things I think we see here is a sort of break and a rupture between the intellectually produced nationalism, as you said, and the sort of reality of Afghanistan as a multicultural, extremely diverse place. And that's a quite interesting point that you highlight very well. So bringing us to the more recent period, the National Constitution of the Islamic Republic attempted in some ways to embrace a more multiculturalist approach, as you point out, but also fell short in the real politics of that in many ways. One of the examples we read about was the example of Pashtunwali and particularly Baad. Can you give a little more sense of how in cases like this, where you do have these traditional practices that are in violation of commonly agreed upon human rights, how ideally should that be negotiated?
Okay, so this example that you highlighted, that's on chapter 6, where I discuss how recognition of cultural diversity or group rights, which is central to the idea of multiculturalism, may in certain cases violate individual choice or individual liberty or individual rights. So the idea is, can we negotiate or somehow bring these two together, the idea of individual rights with group rights? So because you cannot neglect an autonomous individual, but at the same time, we in the contemporary globalized world, we cannot also neglect the fact that societies are multicultural, and then these cultures are deeply embedded into the identity of individuals and communities. So that's why we have to bring them together. So I looked at the three cases, how these negotiations take place between the state, community, and individual. One of the case was literary censorship or religious limitations on individual choices. The fact that we currently see under the second phase of Taliban rule, right? So one of the popular example was a novel by Taqi Bakhtiari called Gumnomi, where he narrates, it's a novel, it's a fiction, and he narrates the how, for example, a new student in a madrasa has been harassed by a mullah or a khand. So this triggered somehow a protest and probably this hurt sentiments of religious people in Afghan, particularly this, because this is talking about Shia madrasa. So primary reaction came from some of the Shia Akhunds. There's a famous case in the English-speaking world, which is called Rushdie Affairs. So this is somehow similar to Rushdie Affairs. And Rushdie Affairs, somehow society in Britain failed to have a constructive dialogue with each other. Right. For example, the Muslims demanded a simple thing, how, for example, Salman Rushdie should just acknowledge the fact that whatever is narrated in the book is not a historical fact, rather it's a fiction. And right. This was a primary demand. Both sides failed somehow to come along and create a way forward. But in Afghanistan, it was conservative community who could not, for example, tolerate the idea that a novelist can narrate with something which is fiction. So that's why the book was born. The author himself was also accused that he has done blasphemy. Second case is what you say, the case of Pashtunwali, which is a code of conduct in most of the rural communities. And some of the practices, of course, probably violates individual rights. And the case that I have highlighted in chapter 6 goes back to 2015. A guy from Paktia province called Adil, he protested his family, but he was kicked out of his family. And then he protested the community at his village. Again, people did not accept him in the village, and he was finally kicked out of the province. He came to Kabul protesting that the protest was against the Baad, which is giving in a rural communities when two people, two communities or two families, probably they have a conflict and someone is killed, in order to address the grievances of the victim family, people provide, for example, they exchange girls. And that is somehow called as a kind of remedy. So this is, of course, violating fundamental individual fundamental individual right of women, that without their consent, they are exchanged as a commodity. He was not heard. And finally, he came to Kabul. He sat in front of the parliament and demanded legislation should be passed in order to address this challenge in most of the rural communities. So everyone was sympathizing with him. Most of the politicians visited him sympathizing, but no one took a step forward in order to legalize this issue,
right,
or what was his demand. And so this case, again, for me, represented a kind of failure of intercultural dialogue at the community level, but also at the state level, where in community, people could not tolerate an individual. He was from themselves, right? He was not an external actor to come along and have a debate and then resolve this issue. But also at the state level, politicians tried to ignore it. Probably the assumption was this is very sensitive, and if we move forward to, for example, legalize certain codes of conduct or behavior, or prohibit things which are deeply embedded at the community level, that might push back. So that was a negative case. But there is a successful case of intercultural dialogue in Afghanistan. This is with regard to Shia personal law. This act was drafted, first of all, by a number of Shia religious clerks, and they came with a very traditional code which prohibited certain form of freedom for women. This was protested by intellectuals within Shia community, but also out of Shia community. While the intellectuals who protested against the code, they were not against the code per se. That they appreciated the fact that minorities like Shias do require, for instance, a certain form of legal status, and their jurisprudence should be recognized by the state, right? That was not a matter of contention. The issue was that how, for example, this act, while it recognizes Shia jurisprudence, it should also appreciate the fact that women rights and individual rights should be acknowledged. So then there was a kind of violent encounter between the parties, but at the end, this conversation led to a kind of constructive outcome, which was reform of the act at the end of the day. So what I conclude here is, in conflictual societies and fragmented societies like Afghanistan, an intercultural dialogue between different communities, different cultures, different ways of life on one hand, but also between individual and community on the other hand, is quite challenging. In most of the cases, it fails. In certain cases where both parties express or show tolerance, that might lead to a positive outcome.
When you refer to nationalism and its discontents, this, of course, is a nod towards Freud, which I think is who wrote Civilization and Its Discontents, which I think is a very interesting way of highlighting. In both of these cases, you talk about Bob, for instance. It is a question of not having the legal mechanism, but B, it doesn't even get to a legal mechanism because the conversation's not happening. Nobody's hearing Adele, as you say, right? Mm-hmm. So when you think about this, and when you think about really the fact that the sort of 20-year experiment of the Islamic Republic failed to consistently generate these venues where we could have those dialogues. What if you could go back, how would you have suggested that they encourage Afghanistan not just to think about sort of legal avenues for multiculturalism, as you pointed out, but how do we encourage the dialogues that you are suggesting?
I think one of the key problems or challenges which prevents emergence of a dialogue and societies like Afghanistan is, I think, the security dilemma that the state suffers from. Mm-hmm. Most of the states in third world are weak. And this weakness is not challenged from outside, but mainly from inside, because the societies are strong. These are strong states, strong societies and weak states, as Hugh Macdowell has written.
Mm-hmm.
So any demand from society is perceived by the state as a challenge to the sovereignty, to the national integrity, territorial integrity of a state. So that's why it is suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
It's seen as a threat. So either you have to confirm with the official narrative or nationalism of the state, or you're looked as a dissentant. And of course, a dissent is not possible in these kind of states. So that's why, number one, I would have suggested that let's not securitize or politicize most of these items which are controversial in our society, right? Let's look at it as a cultural issue, but also as something which could be dealt with through dialogue, not as a security problem. Because whenever a state securitizes these issues, the avenue for dialogue is closed because it's a security matter, and the state will deal it with it through a suppression. The police will suppress it, or the courts will suppress it, or administrative procedures will suppress it. Secondly, to appreciate what is there as a fact probably in our society, and that is diversity. And the diversity now in our societies may not be accommodated in the model of a state that we have borrowed from the Western societies. So that's why I have this issue that we need to constantly question the Westphalian model of centralized state, because an early phase when a state was constructed in the Western Europe, it was a highly bureaucratic architecture and very centralized one in order to administer society, right? So it developed codes of conduct, rules and regulations, a strong bureaucracy. And this strong bureaucracy went directly against communities in order to construct an autonomous individual. So if you see the interaction between the state as an institution, communities as a society, and individual, the dynamics between these three and last, for example, 200-300s across the globe, but also particularly in the societies that they created successful models of a state, stable state, the interaction is this way. A state goes against communities because it looks at communities as an institution which prevents monopoly over use of violence, number one. And secondly, it also prevents construction of an autonomous individual. So that's why anything which is associated with the communities should be eradicated in order to carve out an individual autonomous human being. This is somehow what one contemporary philosopher who has a book on how liberalism failed, Patrick Deneen, dwells on this question, that how modernity created this crisis for us. So that's why, what is the way out? The way out is that a state should not perceive communities and group cultures as a challenge, both to itself, but also to the individual, because individual is deeply embedded in these cultures, and our practices, ways of life, the meaning that we have, it comes from the culture. So a state should not be anti-culture, basically. It should appreciate the culture. The last step would be that instead of constructing a Westphalian model of very centralized state, which is antagonized to the communities, we need to allow communities to govern themselves. Mm-hmm. What does it mean politically? That means that we need to have a decentralized state. Formal institutions should appreciate informal institutions which exist in communities. That means recognizing the community and culture. Until and unless you do not recognize and appreciate culture, you cannot establish a decentralized state. So there is a kind of very meaningful relationship between the formal institutions, a decentralized state, and the way we understand and perceive and encounter with cultures and communities. So that's why the last solution is creating a decentralized state to allow communities. But of course, these communities, now the dilemma is that how communities will respect individual rights that we have addressed, I think.
And what would a more decentralized, I'm assuming sort of federal state look at, like ideally in Afghanistan in your mind?
Oh, this is a good question. I think let me give you an example of probably Kunduz or Tahar or Badakhshan. And these provinces are quite diverse. Probably one village is on Uzbek and another village is a Tajik, or the third village could be an Arab, right? Like Tahar, it's a Persianized province, but deeply divided in terms of at a very not macro level, micro level, between villages, you will find diversity. Yeah. Now, in this kind of context, if you frame a federal political system, which recognizes form of self-governance or autonomy at the regional level. For example, let's say you divide Afghanistan into 5 or 6 decentralized but autonomous federal states, right? This will create a challenge for us, I assume, because the groups are not living in a segregated communities.
Right.
In most of the part of the country, ethnic groups are living side by side. Probably one village is A ethnicity, the another village is ethnicity B or C, right? So that's why it's very difficult to say carve out an ethnic model of federalism for Afghanistan, where you say the north will be Tajiks, the south will be Pashtuns, the center will be Hazaras, and that's all, we resolve the conflict. But alternatively, I must say, a Switzerland model of federalism might work for Afghanistan, wherein you have numerous and multiple autonomous local councils. For example, it depends on how do we define the lowest level of administrative unit. Now, the lowest level of administrative unit in Afghanistan is not village, because a state doesn't have institutions to govern village.
Right.
It is district. So below district, whatever it is, it's informal. For example, you may have a village which is run by a malik or kharyadar.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is, let's appreciate in a state of district, let's appreciate villages as the primary unit or administrative unit, but recognize these institutions which govern the village and also devolve certain authorities to village. So that will give the autonomy back to communities. Communities may know in certain things and in most of the issues, how to govern themselves. For example, scholars like Jennifer Murtazashvili have studied, she has studied how communities, for example, when it comes to regulation of water, schooling, for example, or for example, resolution of disputes, they are so much efficient and they do not need intervention from the center to resolve these.
Right.
So what we need to do is, because there are multiple models of federalism across the world, we need to appreciate that diversity in Afghanistan is very localized. It's not at the regional level. And any sort of institutions that we design, it should consider that localized level of diversity so that it should not lead to another tension between, for example, X community versus Y, X ethnicity right. versus Y ethnicity. So it is a bit tricky, but yeah. I must say Switzerland as a model will work because Switzerland, first of all, has appreciated the ethnic diversity within the country, but at the same time, at the local level, it has empowered communities and councils that they have, I think, both administrative but also legislative authority to regulate and administer communities and society.
Fascinating, and I think great recommendations. One of the things that strikes me is, I think sometimes when you hear suggestions like this, they sound somewhat radical in the Afghan context, and yet I think in a lot of ways, looking closely at how the society works, it is less radical. That one of the things that always sort of stood out for me when I was living in a Tajik town was, they would say, "Oh, we're Tajiks. We only marry other Tajiks." And then he would say, "Oh, but," and then you would hear, "But my sister, he's married to a Pashtun woman, and my sister, she's married to a Hazara man." And all of a sudden you realize they keep saying, "Oh, we only marry Tajiks." And yet there's this immense diversity in terms of how families are actually created. And I think somewhat similarly in terms of these informal local political mechanisms, oftentimes the way they're described sounds challenging to the state. And yet, as you pointed out in Jennifer's work or in some of your own, looking at the way these informal institutions already run much of Afghanistan is really important as well. So let's also say one of the things that has come up several times has been both the ruptures brought in by the new Taliban regime, but also some of the continuities. And I think when we think about some of these informal institutions, it allows us also to understand how sort of life in a village under Karzai, under Ghani, and now under the Taliban, in some ways has not probably shifted as much as we might imagine externally. because so much is being done by those informal mechanisms. But let's turn to this new Taliban era. And you talk in a recent article for Fair Observer about organic intellectuals who in recent months have worked sort of internationally and on social media to justify engagement with the Taliban. Can you briefly describe what you mean by these organic intellectuals and how we should be responding to them and how this sort of fits in with some of your other arguments as well that you've been describing?
Sure. The terminology is borrowed from Anthony Gramsci, who was a leftist scholar. He spent most of his life writing notes of prison and the time when Mussolini imprisoned him. So the term organic intellectual, one of the good examples or metaphors that he uses is centaur. Centaur is that beast animal which has human features also, but at the same time, animal features. Why hegemony functions like a centaur? Because unlike brutal use of force, hegemony uses norms, cultures, and particularly civil society as an instrument in order to construct consent. So who operates in this affair of norm, culture, and civil society? Civil society, we assume it is autonomous, and hence, so that means it's out of control of the state. But here Gramsci says that the state influences and utilizes these institutions in order to shape consent for its own purposes. So intellectuals, according to him, are two different types. One is traditional intellectuals, the other is organic intellectuals. So organic intellectuals are those group of people who are linked with one class in society. Now, in context of Taliban, I might have been wrong, but I could not find any other terminology in order to capture or understand those individuals who try to rationalize engagement with the Taliban at this moment. Now, this is, of course, controversial whether to engage or not engage, but a prior question would be, what is Taliban? Who are Taliban? Taliban as a religious political movement, they are a reality. But the fact is, do they have enough legitimacy? Or in other words, are they not an evil to govern a society? If they are evil, and we appreciate them as an evil, that means they don't have any legitimacy to rule the society, right? And then that's why any form of encounter or engagement that you have with them, you need to rethink and rationalize and provide a logic for it. Why do you want to engage with them, or why do you want to accept them as a ruler? Now, so that's number one issue. And then there are so many other reasons that scholars or probably activists try to bring in when the question of Taliban and the way policymakers want to engage them would come for. One is law and order. The assumption is that if we accept Taliban at this moment, because Afghanistan had bloody 40 years of history, it will reduce the cost of governance, it will establish order, and gradually, slowly and systematically, probably through engagement, we will be able to convert or change the Taliban and somehow civilize them. Now, what I argue that we have 27 years of lived experience with the Taliban. This is not the very first time encounter with Taliban. So we know history will teach us, and as a social scientist, I think we need to refer back to episodes in history and understand. Without our encounter with the history, we cannot draw a clear pathway towards our future. And based on history, all of these two, three arguments which are put forward by organic intellectuals pro-Taliban, they are not correct. So first of all, let's say Taliban are reformable, or we can civilize them through a kind of peaceful engagement. Now, this is not possible because any form of peaceful engagement requires recognition of non-Taliban by the Taliban. So far, the Taliban do not recognize anyone who is non-Taliban politically, right? For example, what about freedom of media? What about freedom of political parties in Afghanistan at this moment? It is not at all allowed, right? So if the Taliban do not recognize non-Talibans, to what extent the possibility of this intercultural dialogue might be there? So if there is no possibility or avenue for a kind of dialogue, how do we expect Taliban to change? That's also not possible. Secondly, Taliban is a totalitarian movement, to my understanding, and that is quite simple and straightforward. Any movement or any model of governance which suppresses civil society is totalitarian. And Taliban does that when Taliban tries to regulate every aspect of individual and collective life. Be it, for example, your choice about how to wear clothes, how to hear, what to listen, so on and so forth, all regulated by the Taliban. How many civil society organizations we have lost in the last 8 months? It's countless. So imagine that society who doesn't have civil society. How you expect Taliban to transform? Because a transformation may happen if you have a strong civil society, because that will create a very dynamic, vibrant society wherein people will encounter out of sphere of the state. And therein you can probably have the opportunity to socialize Taliban in a different set of norms, in a different set of culture. But if we don't have civil society, that possibility is down to zero. So that's why any kind of hope that a totalitarian movement will change in Afghanistan and be Taliban without the existence of a civil society, that's not possible. And there are some other, I think, arguments that I also lay out. So anyway, but to be brief, number one, Taliban cannot establish order because the nature of the movement is as such that they are socialized in a way that they should constantly have this ideology. And in order to survive Taliban as a movement themselves, they require this violent ideology. And rather violent ideology will lead to forms of extremism. And at the end, it might lead to terrorism. The way, for example, they host international terrorist organizations, because they are very comfortable with their own international community. Mm-hmm. And that is international community of jihadists. Mm-hmm. So an order is logically impossible under such kind of circumstances. Apart from all of this, I think there are two, philosophically, if you look at it, the moralist question in politics and also a realist question in politics. Realist, for example, William Bernard, who is a British philosopher, he says the primary question in politics before anything else is the question of legitimacy, basic demand for legitimacy. Anyone who is ruled by someone, they have a right to ask why and based on what you are there to rule me, right? And I think Taliban ignores completely this. They are not at all bothered about basis of their legitimacy. That's a realist question. And moralist question, how shall I support or endorse a movement which constantly in the last 20 years they've targeted civilians and currently also they perpetuate quite unjust rule. They violate constantly basic rights of human beings. So morally, this is impossible for anyone who endorses a kind of moral principle to go forward and appreciate and accept Taliban, be it as a ruler or be it as any other kind of authority in Afghanistan.
Thanks so much, Doctor. There's really a lot to think about, particularly bringing it back to that idea of political activity or politics as an intellectual activity and thinking through what does that engagement actually mean morally, ethically, and ultimately politically. A lot to think about. I'm going to leave it here.
Well, that was me talking to Professor Noah Coburn. If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe to this podcast and make sure to share it with your friends on social media. Also, if you would like to know more about Afghanistan, how Afghan nationalism failed, and which model of multiculturalism shall fit for Afghanistan, please do purchase a copy of my book and read it, and let me know what do you think. Thank you for listening to this episode. Looking forward to talking to you in the next session.